I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The Secret History of Soldiers, How Canadians Survived the Great War is the new book from the distinguished historian Tim Cook. He joins me now, and I'll get him to tell us about this book and how, in spite of the horrible conditions of war, Canadian soldiers managed to make it through their daily lives. These soldiers found solace, distraction, and entertainment through song, trench art, postcards, even through raunchy sketches. What's fascinating about this book is how Cook goes about finding out this stuff. He mines letters, diaries, memoirs, and oral accounts. I'll also get Mr. Cook to reflect about how this shaped the Canadian psyche, especially the sense Canadians had of themselves after World War I. Tim Cook is a great war historian at the Canadian War Museum. He has written 10 previous books, including At the Sharp End and Vimy, each of which have won the J.W. Defoe Prize. His book, Shock Troops, won the 2009 Charles Taylor Prize for Literary Nonfiction. Other awards that Mr. Cook has received include 2 C.P. Stacey Prizes, and in 2013, he was a recipient of the Pierre Burton Award for Popularizing Canadian History. He is a member of the Order of Canada. This new book is published by Allen Lane Canada. Please welcome to the Plante on the Line program, Tim Cook. Mr. Cook, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I was just telling you before we started just how much I'm enjoying this book, so we'll have a lot to talk about. I guess what struck me as I'm reading it is this is an important side as to what soldiers would do between battles, say. And it's fascinating, and I guess I'm wondering, when did you, I don't know if when did you decide is the right word, but I mean, when did you realize that there was a book here that could be done about something that's been so overlooked?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been lucky to study the First World War for about 25 years now, and this is my 11th book. But you're right, it's quite different than the other ones. Most of the books focus on battles and tactics and commanders and the experience of soldiers as well. But this cultural history of the war, the use of culture as a shield, revealed itself to me only slowly, and only by reading thousands and thousands of letters and diary entries and memoirs. And that's really where the history comes from. My other books have researched deeply into the official records. Those would be the war diaries or operational reports, medical reports, that kind of thing. But if you were looking for the secret history of soldiers, as I've called it in those records, you wouldn't find it. It comes from the soldiers. They talk about it only in their own private correspondence. And that's where I encountered it, the songs, the poetry, the trench newspapers, the superstitions, and all the other material, I think, that informs and makes up this really unique culture.
So I'll ask you in a moment or two about certain aspects of culture that are prevalent amongst these soldiers. But those that went to war, you know, it's hard for us to realize just over 100 years later the sort of men that went to war. I mean, what sort of social strata did these soldiers usually come from, say? I mean, these are 619,636 who were enlisted and or conscripted, right?
Mm-hmm, that's right. Yeah, well, they came from across the country. I mean, that's a huge number, 620,000 Canadians who served. It's from a country of 8 million. So we're 5 times as large today. Mm-hmm. Today's equivalent would be 3.5 million citizen soldiers, because these guys, for the most part, were not professional, who were serving in an expeditionary force. It's really unthinkable. And it was an enormous undertaking by Canada from 1914 to 1918. And so these Canadians, for the most part, young men, they were supposed to be between the ages of 18 and 45, but thousands of guys lied about their age, and I found 12-year-olds who have made it overseas, and the older men lied about their age, too. They came from all classes, although most came from the working class, but they were farmers and bankers and students and manufacturers and everything under the sun. All parts of the country, almost all religions. And so, you know, this is a slice of Canada. It's a slice that's largely about men in a certain age group. And I hadn't realized before in my other books, but just thinking about it, it's probably not surprising that they began to create their own culture, some of which they brought with them. So the popular songs of the day or playing sports or the things that excited them when they were civilians and citizens back in Canada. But then they bring that into the trenches, and it's changed. It's changed by this horrific environment in which they find themselves, in the trenches on the Western Front, in the sites of mass murder, as I call them, the death and destruction. And there the culture becomes a way to help to forge their unique society.
And was there, because of trench warfare, I mean, what does that change in terms of how soldiers were with one another? Say the interaction between soldiers and officers, for example. I mean, was war itself a sort of great leveler, if you will?
It was to some degree, I think. When we talk about the junior officers, especially, the generals who were largely far from front are not as intimately involved in this culture. It's a culture of the trenches and behind the lines and the cycling of soldiers into those front lines and then back again in a continuous cycle that goes on throughout the war. And as I argue in the book, if you look at the culture, if you look at the songs and the cartoons and the rumors and trench art, a lot of this is a pushback against authority.
Yeah.
We see the soldiers' agency here. They're not mindless zombies lurching from one disaster to another. And I think sometimes, I mean, if I say that out loud, we probably would go, well, of course not. They were young guys. They're trying to survive. They're coping. But if you look at the films and the plays and the novels that have come out of the First World War, it's really a focus on that maelstrom of destruction, the soldiers as victim. Everyone seems to be killed or maimed or driven insane. And this is a book that where I don't diminish that. I don't diminish the horror of the trenches, but I also say there's another side to it, and we need to look at how they survived. Why is it that most of them did not break down? And I argue it's because of this society and banding with the guy beside you and unit cohesion, but also this culture that is very much a shield.
And so when, I mean, whenever you're pressed into a difficult situation, as most people are, I mean, gallows humor, I guess, is the thing that helps a lot of people. And in this case, that was very much the case, wasn't it, in this conflict with these men?
Yeah, I think it is. And that comes out when you're reading these eyewitness accounts by the soldiers, those who lived and those who died. And they talk about it quite openly because they're trying to explain to their loved ones at home or their friends how they are surviving. And it's really much a dark culture, a gallows culture. We shouldn't be surprised. It's mostly young men in a very difficult situation. And so their jokes, their humorous songs are all steeped in death and about being killed. And of course, the more that they sing about that, the more they want to live. And it extends to the dead as well. This is a battlefield, the Western Front, where the unburied corpses lay by the tens of thousands, and the rotting dead are in the trenches with the soldiers. And the first couple times you read about this in their letters and diaries, about playing with the dead, rearranging bones, hanging your helmet or your respirator off, or a femur jutting from the wall, it's quite shocking.
Yeah.
But I think when you begin to realize that this is how they're coping with this, and they say that, you know, they say we would have been driven mad if we hadn't been able to do this, you begin to understand, I think, a little bit more of how they are moving forward and continuing to serve. And that's really the core question, I think. I mean, how do these guys keep fighting in these conditions, which are unthinkable today?
Now, when you would come across something that's raunchy, I mean, it shouldn't surprise somebody that I mean, as you said a moment ago, these are young men, and they're far away from home. And so naturally, this sort of banter, I guess, would be prevalent. But even for 100 years ago or more, 103, 104 years, does that surprise you as to sort of the level of raunchiness, say, that you'd see come across?
It did a little bit. I mean, I have a full chapter on slang and swearing, and their songs are famously dirty and vulgar. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there are issues of masculinity here. These are young guys who are finding and having to coarsen themselves to survive in these terrible conditions. And if you think about it, it's not surprising that everyone swore. It's a very manly society.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, it was great fun to research the origin of the F word and, mm-hmm. and how these profanities and vulgarities emerge over time. And it's in their songs. And again, it's a part of this culture. And if we look at the vulgarity and brutality of it, you can very much see how these soldiers who are physically isolated on the Western Front are also isolating themselves through their culture, through their words, through their songs. And all of that, again, I think, offers some insight into the big question of coping.
Yeah, it's insulation, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah, you've talked about sort of the flavor that you get from these letters, diaries, memoirs. That you've looked at over the years as a historian. When you compare it to, say, other conflicts, especially the Second War or even current conflict where Canadian forces are today, say, in Afghanistan, is there... I mean, I wonder about letter writing today, not mm-hmm. just in a conflict context, but yeah. There's something different, isn't there, about the writing home that you see from the Great War?
I think there is. The First World War is very much a writing war to some degree. Even though the average education level is about grade 6, that's deceiving because everyone is writing letters. And they're writing, of course, because there's no way to communicate home otherwise. Mm-hmm. If you are gone for 1, 2, 3 years, some guys up to 5 years, you stay in touch with postcards and letters, and I write about that and the importance of those letters and what is being communicated home. There was formal censorship, which was not as formal or as rigorous as some believe, but more importantly was the self-censorship, I think. It was tough mm-hmm. to talk about these experiences with your mom. And there's a difference between how soldiers talk to their dads and their brothers than it is to their sisters and to their mothers. But the letters are absolutely crucial. That's the lifeline home. And those letters that return from home, often in a care package, really help to sustain the soldiers. To come back to your question, it is different. I've written 4 books on the Second World War, including a 2-volume history, The Necessary War and Fight to the Finish, very much about the sailors and the airmen and the nurses and the troopers and the infantrymen. And the letters are quite different if you look at the 2 of them, as I have. Mm-hmm. For one, there's not as many letters in the archives. I think they're still held by the family. We still have 20 to 30,000 Second World War veterans alive from the 1.1 million who served. And if you were to look in the more modern period, of course, it's very different. I haven't studied that. I haven't written about Afghanistan. But just with the cell phones and the ability to communicate, as all of us do in society, letters become far less prominent. And I and others have worried a little bit about how will the historians of the future try to write about, for instance, in this case, the cultural or social history of soldiers in Afghanistan. You'll have to approach it from a very different perspective. My only hope there is that I think that those communications, be they letters or email today or something else, they matter. They mattered in 1914 to 1918. They matter from 1939 to 1945, and they matter from 2001 to 2011 or 14.
Yeah.
Right? These things matter to people, so they keep them. And that is the stuff of history, and that's what the historians of the future, I imagine, will use to try to reconstruct the various periods they are studying.
Yeah, a lot of people who get letters from, say, soldiers overseas aren't going to be deleting these emails. But like everything else with regards to technology, we're I guess, at the mercy of, say, a forgotten password or a server going down and losing
yep.
a bunch of stuff, you know. That's yep. a heartbreaking thing, isn't it, about your trade?
It is. I mean, the historian's craft, and I imagine others as well, is often about trying to reconstruct the past through the various fragments that survive. In the First World War, with 620,000 soldiers and every man writing 2 to 3, 4 letters a week, I mean, there are tens and tens of millions of letters that were written. How many have survived? It's a small fragment, but it's still fairly large. I have traveled the country reading letters and diaries and archives and historical societies. I work at the Canadian War Museum. We have an archives here. I go to the Library Archives of Canada. People send me letters and diaries and memoirs now, and I'm always struck by them because they are so powerful. They are sometimes terribly mundane and banal. They're about the weather. They're about the dirt, dry socks. But when you begin to look, they talk about the songs that keep them going, about the trench newspapers that they are reading. And that's an important part of my book, where I was able to draw out some of this culture from these newspapers published by the soldiers, for the soldiers, often in the trenches. And they're an incredible resource. But it remains a fragment, and for someone like me, I've had the luxury to spend many years with these soldiers, this generation that has now moved on. We lost our last First World War veteran in 2010, but their legacy survives in their letters, in their diaries, in the war art, in the film, in the photographs. Some of which are in museums and archives, but a lot of which are still with the families across this country.
Yeah. What do you make when people talk about, say, Canada's sense of self being shaped by this war? And then when you look at the secret history, as you've written about in your new book, I mean, this secret history that we haven't known about heretofore, I mean, it really does play a part in how we've defined ourselves, hasn't it?
I think it is. I think the First World War writ large is just a profoundly important event in Canadian history, 50 years after Confederation, and it was a major traumatic event. 66,000 Canadians killed, 170,000 wounded. That led to a whole new group of veterans in our society. It led to a new medical system to care for the wounded. It saw massive political changes, the rise of anger in the West, the rise of a third party, the Progressives, who eventually become the CCF and the NDP, the rise of women into the workforce and receiving the right to vote in 1918. That would have come at some point, but it's linked to the war. The paying for the war, the introduction of income tax, which comes in 1916, still with us today. Mm-hmm. Political change, where Canada steps out onto the world stage, where we're recognized for service and sacrifice. The list could go on, but it is a powerful legacy that is still with us. I think, however, how we remember it today, 100 years later, is largely through a commemorative lens. It is about the fallen soldiers. It's captured on Remembrance Day. The poppy, 2 minutes of silence, John McCrae's poem in Flanders Fields. They're all linked to the First World War. Mm-hmm. Today they represent all service, all sacrifice. But that lens, I think, is a very powerful one. And in my book, The Secret History of Soldiers, I push back a little bit against that when I look at the war through the soldiers' culture. Because for the veterans who came back, they were very much horrified by the war and what they had lived through and what they had been forced to do. But at the same time, there was a sense of nostalgia as the years march on, the camaraderie of the trenches. They missed that. And they band together after the war in various veterans groups and the Legion. Mm-hmm. They have newspapers and publications like in the First World War. They send letters to one another. The songs of the war remain a powerful memory device for them. And the War of the Veterans, when viewed through this secret culture, is different in significant ways, I argue in the book, than the broader spectrum of the war as a really a senseless slaughter, or the opposite of that, the war that really propels us to full nationhood. There's a different strand of memory that emerges when you look at the culture, and I think that's maybe a significant contribution from the book.
There's a great lesson as I'm reading the book that I'm deriving, and I'm sure a lot of readers will, about survival, about how to survive from the example that these soldiers from their experiences. What accounts for this resiliency that gets them through, you know, this horrific, violent, terrible mm-hmm. war?
Well, it's a good word you use there, resiliency, and I think that's one of the things I try to get at. We have to acknowledge to some degree that this was a tough generation. They were used to hardship in a way that we aren't today. One meal a day was quite common. Doing hard manual labor your whole life, no matter what wounds or aches you had. This, too, is common for many Canadians. But it has to go beyond that. It has to go beyond that they were tough guys. And there's aspects of discipline and command, all of which are important. But this resiliency, I argue, is built through the special society of the soldiers that emerges, and it's the culture that does that. And so it's how they deal with the stress and strain, with the dark humor, through a strong sense of masculinity, which is revealed in this culture, through finding ways to keep going despite the horror. And that survival instinct is an important one, and it's difficult to quantify. But I try to lay that out in the book in the various ways, because I think it goes to that core question of why did those armies fight for so long? Why didn't they give up? How did they keep going?
Now you're a historian, Tim, and as you mentioned, you work at the Canadian War Museum, and your specialty is the Great War. We're about a month away, or about a month or so away from Remembrance Day, and so I'm wondering, what is that day, November the 11th? What do you think about year after year, especially since this is your work, and by extension, I mean, are there things that we should be thinking about as well on that day?
Yeah, I do. It is a day where I'm lucky to live in Ottawa, so I'm usually down at the National Cenotaph here. I'm often on the radio or television on that day, working usually for CBC to offer some commentary. I think of a number of things. I think of those veterans who I've known in my life. My grandfather flew in Bomber Command in the Second World War. I've met dozens of First World War soldiers before they passed away. I think also of the families, and I think that it's a day where we often think about those who served and those who were killed and those who survived. But I think often of the families, of the wives, of the children, of the parents who had to welcome back these young men, depending on the war we're talking about, some young women now, of course, as well. Mm-hmm. Who came back changed, who came back troubled, who came back with different experiences, not always negative. I mean, that's important to point out. Yeah. Often soldiers often said it was the greatest adventure of their lives, and of course it was. It was an adventure tinged with death and the chance of being killed, but it was something quite unique. And I think about those that constellation of ideas, some of which are conflicting. I think that we can say that war is horrible, but Canada has gone to war many times in its history when it believes in the cause. I think we can talk about heroics in warfare and bravery while also finding a space for soldiers who could not cope and had to break down or simply did break down. So it's a day for me that goes beyond the simple icons and symbols, which I think matter still, but the poppy and 2 minutes of silence, and those are a good way to focus the mind on that day. But I think for myself, and I would probably suggest for many Canadians, there's often a strong personal connection to that day, and that is often something that resonates across the country.
Your book has given me a lot to think about as I'm reading it. And I'm sure a lot of readers who will pick up the book, and I urge a lot of people to pick it up, because it's a good book. I've admired your work over the years a great deal, so this has been a great pleasure for me to speak with you. I so appreciate your time today. Thanks for this, and good luck with this book, Tim.
Thanks very much.
The book is called The Secret History of Soldiers, How Canadians Survived the Great War. It's published by Allen Lane Canada. Tim Cook, its author, joined me on the line from Ottawa and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.